Russia has also been investing heavily in media aimed at foreigners. Americans curious about Kremlin policy on Syria can check out the cable channel Russia Today. The U.S. government-funded Voice of America, on the other hand, took its Russian service off the air. It now exists only as a website. NPR's Michelle Kellerman, who herself once worked for the VOA, reports that website recently fell victim to Kremlin tricks.
Russian anti-corruption crusader Alexei Navalny has been the victim of many dirty tricks by pro-Kremlin media. But when the Voice of America published an online interview that had him criticizing other Russian opposition figures, Navalny quickly tweeted that the interview was a fake. "It seems the VOA has gone nuts," he wrote to his Twitter followers. VOA director David Ensor apologized and said the Russian service has tightened its procedures.
But you know, in the digital age, it is increasingly difficult sometimes to know who it is you are in contact with. And in Russia, there are a number of entities, including some connected with the Kremlin, that make a business out of trying to confuse the image of people like Mr. Navalny by impersonating him and doing various things. So it looks like we may have been scammed, but we may never know for sure.
Navalny wouldn't comment for this story. Ensor says VOA journalists have made their peace with him.
One of our stringers reached Mr. Navalny at a demonstration and said, "Look, we're really sorry if we got it wrong. Did we get it wrong?" And he said, "Hey, don't mention it. Don't worry about it. There's a lot of stuff going on around here."
But others don't see this as an isolated incident. Ted Lippian, a former VOA employee, says the Russian service relies now on contractors who aren't familiar with American journalistic values.
And I'm not saying that one should not hire people with fresh knowledge of countries like Russia. But if you are the Voice of America, you also need seasoned editors with other experience, American experience.
In this webcast, for instance, the VOA host hardly pushes back in a lengthy interview with a pro-Putin youth leader who complains that the U.S. is trying to foment revolution in his country. VOA director Ensor says journalists are just trying to be balanced and credible.
You're going to hear people on there that are sympathetic to Putin. You're going to hear, for sure, people who are not sympathetic to Putin. Is the mix right on every single show? Maybe not. And that's probably also true at National Public Radio.
Outside reviews of VOA's Russian service have raised concerns. A Senate staffer familiar with them says the reviews mostly call on VOA to provide more coverage of corruption and human rights. But the staffer says there is, quote, no smoking gun to indicate a deliberate pro-Putin bias. There is another problem, says Ted Lippian, who co-founded the Committee for U.S. International Broadcasting.
The Voice of America Russian service has no radio or television programs. So their audience in Russia is minuscule because of that.
VOA says it's getting more hits than ever on its website and has a growing Twitter following of 30,000. It's also starting an interactive social media show despite a shrinking budget. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
In the U.S., Congress hopes to subsidize the extended payroll tax holiday, partly by auctioning off sections of the broadcast spectrum. In theory, that could result in better and cheaper mobile broadband services. But as NPR's Annie Baxter reports, those potential benefits are likely years away.
TVs, radios, and cell phones all rely on the broadcast spectrum to carry information. But some parts of the spectrum are worth more than others.
It's the beachfront property. It's the Santa Monica Beach equivalent.
That's Blair Levin, a former chief of staff at the Federal Communications Commission. He says the FCC will be auctioning off that pricey property. Television broadcasters currently live there. An auction would allow them to give up their spots in exchange for a lot of money. Then the government would give those slots to the highest bidders among, say, cell phone companies. Presumably, wireless services would improve and rates would go down as a result. Levin likes the idea in principle, but he says the actual deal hatched is too complicated and will take years to implement.
In the time frame of 2014, 2015, 2016, we could find ourselves in a situation where our service is both more expensive and lousier than the rest of the world.
But the time frame doesn't seem off-putting to the National Association of Broadcasters. Spokesman Dennis Wharton says TV stations will have time to figure out if they want to give up their spots or stick around.
Our overriding concern all along has been to make sure that TV stations that want to stay in business are held harmless.
The FCC still has to write the auction rules, that by itself will take a long while. Annie Baxter, NPR News.
Fat Tuesday was traditionally a time to clear the house of indulgent foods before the start of Lent. This led to lots of rich recipes from Shrove pancakes to king cake and a Polish favorite, punchki. In Sweden, it's semlor. Dina Pritchett reports on a group that's keeping semlor and a few other Swedish traditions alive in Portland, Oregon.
Picture soft, sweet rolls, sort of like brioche, piled with creamy almond filling. Now picture them being made by a room full of young, mostly blonde children, speaking Swedish. These are semlor, and they're being made by Svenska Skolan, a Swedish school program that meets Saturday mornings. During the last class, the kids bake the rolls and stash them in the freezer. Now they're whipping cream, grinding almonds, and then putting them together. 9-year-old Sofia Donato and 11-year-old Linnea Nilsson explain.
Right now we're putting in the
filling for the semlor. It's made of almonds, and you cut the top of the semlor off, and then you make a little hole in it, and you put the filling in there, and then you put the lid back on.
Traditionally, semlor were made for Shrove Tuesday as a sort of last hurrah of fat and sugar before Lent. But these days, Sweden is fairly secular, and semlor are just a general treat for the winter season. And though the Swedish school rents space from a church, it's secular too, actually part of a program subsidized by the Swedish government. I'll let one of the Swedes say the name.
Svenska Utlandsskolor.
It's for children with at least one parent who's a Swedish citizen, and has branches all over the world. And a lot of them are probably making semlor right now. Gunilla Rodenbibi is one of the Portland teachers.
It started for Swedish families who were abroad and were coming back. And so they wanted the children to be able to just go back into the school system. But now there are a lot of families, not necessarily will they go back to Sweden, but they still want to have their children part of the Swedish language and culture.
The classes are taught entirely in Swedish and cover history, music, traditional crafts. And they can also be a lesson for the parents. Cecilia Peterson grew up outside of Stockholm and has a daughter in Swedish school.
Some of the things that I have forgotten about the Swedish school reminds me of. They say, okay, in a couple of weeks we're going to make semlor. I was like, oh yeah, semlor. I haven't made that in a long time.
And some parents, like Lena Braun, just appreciate the opportunity to catch up with other Swedish-American families.
Yeah, it's just fantastic to get together on Saturdays, just hanging out and having a good semlor and a cup of coffee. And the kids are playing and having fun, and aren't you? Yeah, I know, it's lots of fun.
Although the kids, like Sofia Donato, have some American ideas about how to improve the semlor.
What if we had, like, chocolate? Like, the bread was chocolate and the almonds was chocolate, like melted chocolate. And then it would be whipped cream with chocolate.
Even without the chocolate, these semlor are a big hit with the kids. Their Shrove Tuesday roots may be more or less forgotten, but the tradition of coming together around Swedish culture and food, and a good strong cup of coffee, is just as sacred a practice. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchup in Portland, Oregon.
I have just walked outside the main NPR headquarters building, and we're in downtown D.C. It is a bright, clear day. I've just laced up my sneakers because I'm about to get chased by zombies. All right, now, this is a new game. We're going to test it out here, and I've got a button here, start mission. All right, here we go.
So you'll see the township as we loop round. Not much more than a few fences to keep the zombies out.
All right, so not sure which is going to be the bigger danger here, getting caught by the zombies, or the traffic that's heading my way from Mass Ave. Let's
Listen.
Pick it up.
If you're alive, if there's anyone alive...
Oh, yeah, I'm
this
alive.
This is Sam Yao from Able Township. You've come down in a nest of hostiles.
Hostiles?
They've heard the noise. They're coming. There are 30... Oh, no, 40.
Oh, dear. That does not sound
good.
Your
only safe path is towards the tower.
The tower.
You should be able to see that from where you are.
I see
there's
a safe
anyone
way.
Alive there, just
I see Chipotle.
Run!
Run! Run! I'm running!
So happily, I did manage to outrun the zombies that time and live to tell the tale. It is all part of a new running game called Zombies Run, and it's designed to encourage folks to exercise. The game is the brainchild of British writer Naomi Alderman, and she says the idea came to her when she signed up for a class for amateur runners.
The start of the course, they said to us, why do you want to learn how to run? And one woman said, I want to be able to outrun the zombie horde. Then I thought, this would be a good idea for a game.
Well, I got a little bit of a taste of it this morning. I was doing laps around the NPR building. And I was very focused on not getting caught by the zombies. But I gather I was also supposed to be on some sort of mission collecting things. Explain to us how this game works.
So the idea is you are runner five. You come from a small base, the last shivering remnant of humanity. You have to go out running, or you can do it by walking. We want to be open to people of all fitness levels. You have to go out to collect supplies for your base. So as you're going, it goes, bing, you got some toilet paper. Bing, you got some bottled water. And when you get back home on your phone, you'll see, okay, you picked up 7 batteries, allot them to a different place in the base. So that gives every run that feeling of, I'm doing something important, I'm growing my base. There's also an ongoing story where at some point somebody will say to you, runner five, there's a child stuck in no man's land. Run to get them before the zombies come.
So these are all these voices that I was hearing as I was running, giving me specific instructions and speed up and slow down. And I have to admit, I mean, you know, it gets you moving. I think I managed to complete level 1. But if you stick with it, you're going to go through various levels and keep getting different assignments. But they're all going to involve trying to get away from the zombies. Is that right?
They are.
Now, one thing I was worried about was, okay, I'm running my fastest, but I don't know if these zombies are sub-6-minute milers or what.
There are different speeds of zombies. Basically, we have something that is called hardcore mode, where if you switch it on, then yeah, the zombies are going to chase you, but you can also turn off hardcore mode, and then there's
I was definitely not in hardcore mode. I was in still need my coffee mode.
Excellent.
I was a bit worried before I went out and actually did it, how you do a game just through a narrative, not, you know, no images that you're looking at here.
Yeah, that was very important to us, because there are other sort of running games that might, like, put some kind of monster in your path, but you have to be looking at the screen in order to see it. And we were just like, this is not safe. So that was where we started. We started with the idea that we wanted to do something where it was all audio. And I would say also, if you have the hardcore mode on where zombies are going to catch you, we very strongly advise you not to do it in traffic.
Not to do it. That was my fatal error. Near fatal error,
no!
I should say, as I was out testing it. Now, I did manage not to get caught by the zombies. Tell me exactly what happens if they catch you.
Well, the first time they catch you, it's just going to say the zombie has caught you. But after a number of times they catch you, then you have failed this mission. You have to start the mission again,
which means
more running. So, you know, good for your heart.
Which is the whole point here anyway, so there you go.
Well, exactly.
That's writer Naomi Alderman. She writes a weekly column on games and technology for The Guardian newspaper, and she created the new game Zombies Run. The app is out for the iPhone February 27th. Naomi, thanks for a great workout.
Great talking to you.